So I mean, the title I think is the non-Gaussian fermionic constants from correlation measures. So yeah, there is just some basic notation for fermions that I was trying to set up. So I'll continue with that later. Let me now do the motivation part. So the kind of the deep reason, let's say, or kind of the main reason for this project, or the main motivation, is that there seems to be sort of a way sometimes to represent complex quantum states, which in general are exponentially, like, yeah, it's exponentially big set, exponentially big space, represent with some polynomial sized ansatzes if there is not so much correlation, right? But then the question is, what do you mean by correlation? Well, you can define it in different ways. In particular, the well-known and quite studied example is the entanglement entropy, right? So you can kind of imagine the many-body Hilbert space as kind of this huge thing. And then you might grade it with respect to sort of bipartite entanglement entropy across some cut. And I mean, let's say the impressionistic picture is that, well, here at the bottom, you have entropy equals zero, and those would be the product states. So they have entropy zero across any cut. And then you can kind of start cranking this up, and kind of you'll have at some point, you'll have entropy order one, and at some point you might have entropy order log n, and you might have also order square root n, and all the way up to order n, which is maximal entropy. And then, so we might grade, let's say, your set of states this way, and this is...
What is n?
N is the size, is the number of qubits or the number of fermions. What people found in particular is that if you have entanglement entropy that's sort of order one or even order log n, is that you can sort of represent it with the matrix product state with constant or polynomial bond dimension. So that is very, very nice and has a lot of applications, but it's also, I think, very conceptually interesting that you have sort of some states which are entangled, which are correlated, but if you just put some sort of constraint on their correlations, you can represent it efficiently using some ansatz. And then, of course, there are different other tensor networks, so somehow there is this connection between tensor networks and entanglement entropy. Now, I want to look at fermions, and fermions, they have this interesting property that if you look at non-interacting systems, then so quadratic Hamiltonians, then they have some different notion of correlation. So the non-interacting fermions, they can have a lot of entanglement, those models. But at the same time, if they're non-interacting, then all those states are Gaussian. Or if you have conserved particle number, they're also called slatted determinants. But I'll just call them Gaussian for simplicity. And we don't really know, let's say, what happens above this, right? So we don't know quite so much as we know about entanglement. Can we maybe, let's say, put some other scale here as would correspond to some fermionic correlations? And entanglement doesn't quite do the job, or it doesn't capture everything, because the Gaussian states, in principle, in general, they are actually volume low entangled. If you take a random Gaussian state, that is volume low entangled. At the same time, those are classically simulable states. And well, we probably better take them seriously because, well, that's first of all, it's a nice mathematical problem, but also it's fermions everywhere, of course. So the question is, what is here? And what is the scale? And of course, there might be different ways of defining this. So I'm going to present you one such way that we found. And that it has completely different mathematical structure compared to tensor networks. So I think that's also just interesting from that perspective. And the number here will be, let me call it k. And it turns out that there is this integer k for which Gaussian states correspond to value 1 of this integer. The entire Hilbert space can be associated with the number n plus 1, where n is the number of fermions. And you can grade the entire Hilbert space into sort of ever-growing subsets, which I will denote hk. And this number k corresponds to a vanishing of a particular correlation measure, a sort of k-body correlation measure. that is called omega k, and that's a k body in the fermionic sense, and I will explain that in detail. So it's a function of a state, and this means that V belongs to HK. And moreover, this gradation that you can introduce, states in there, well, this gradation, let's say, has some physical meaning. I'm going to describe what this meaning is. It can be connected to perturbation theory and also to some non-perturbative states. And also, it admits a polynomial representation with explicit ansatz. Now, I don't know yet if that ansatz is computationally useful. MPS is quite useful. Here, it's sort of, you could think it as it's just basically a mathematical problem of, like, you have a set of states, can you parameterize it with explicitly with some polynomial number of parameters? And maybe in the end, I'll discuss the potential computational applications, but I care about more the mathematical conceptual part of it. So basically, we want to, again, we want to have a gradation such that captures sort of relevant correlations. So it's not some weird sets that don't have to do with anything. Explicit poly-sized ansatz. And maybe sometime later in the future is also computationally useful. So this is the motivation, and I'm gonna present to you something like this, and hopefully it's interesting. Or to me it was. Okay. Are there any questions about motivation? Okay. So let me just briefly review what fermions are. Let me quickly change the check the time. So if you have n fermions on L modes, and I'm going to be considering a fixed number of fermions, n, right? That can be described by these creation annihilation operators that have these commutation relations. So if it's two creation or two annihilation operators, psi, q, and p, they always anticommute. If it's a creation annihilation operator, they anticommute on delta qp. And you have L such operators. So that's what I mean by L modes. And this total particle number operator, which is the sum of psi q dagger psi q, I fix this to be n. So I work in a subspace where this is equal to n. And I'm going to introduce a basis of slatted determinants or Gaussian, this kind of the most simple Gaussian states, which will be associated to this these kind of tuples or sequences S, which are subsets of L and which have length n, right? So you have numbers from S1 to Sn, and this is some subset in the total set of modes. And the state S will be basically creating sort of fermions in the sites from S1 to Sn. And here it's a state without fermions, so it's a complete vacuum. And I will denote this kind of monomial, I will denote it as psi capital S dagger. So I will distinguish between an operator without a foot here and with this kind of dash. So that will be a capital psi. Okay, so this is a basis. So arbitrary state in this Hilbert space that I care about is expressed in terms of these states S with a bunch of amplitudes. For example, if I have L equals 4 and equals 2, so I have two fermions on four modes, then a general state would look like this. This V equals to V of 1, 2, so you occupied first and second fermion mode, and this times this state 1, 2, so S equals to 1, 2 here. And all the way through V of S, V of 3, 4, S, and S equals 2, 3, 4. Okay, so, I mean, I'm sure this is familiar, so this is just the notation I'm going to be using, and these sets S, they're going to be very important. I'm going to be doing stuff with this, so it's just useful notation. Now, what are Gaussian states? So those are basically any states that can be created with from some reference state S that they will call S0 using this kind of exponential of some quadratic form. So I'm sure you're familiar. So that's the Gaussian states. And I mean, the properties are that those are the eigenstates of quadratic Hamiltonians. And in particular, for example, the ground state is that, and you can efficiently find it. And also observables. So observables, expectation value, efficient to compute. OK, so let me just write down. Let me write less on the board. So observables are efficient to compute via Vick's rule, right? So the Vick's rule says, in particular, that if you have some Gaussian state G, and you compute an observable, for example, of this type, so I'll write down a monomial like this. So it's a bunch of annihilation operators and a bunch of creation operators. And this thing is equal to determinant of a matrix that looks like psi q dagger psi p. So it's a matrix in q and p. And q and p are taken from q and capital Q, capital P here. Okay, so this is the Vick's rule. So they're, in principle, exponentially large states, but they have this kind of efficient polynomial description, easy to find eigenstates of and this kind of quadratic Hamiltonians, and observables are easy to compute. So these are these kind of very well-known sort of simple states. And now we're going to ask, OK, what if you don't have those states in this big space of this big Hilbert space? Can we sort of grade states as to how non-Gaussian they are? So let me see what I want to say next. So let me define some a bit less known conditions on what Gaussian states are, because those are going to be generalized for when we go to these non-Gaussian states. Okay. So one not very known condition, or I mean, not everybody knows it, is the purity of row one. I will denote this row one, which is called one particle reduced density matrix in the fermionic sense. And what is this row one? It's equal, so it's a matrix, just L by L matrix for L modes. It's equal to V psi q dagger psi p. Okay. So, and the purity in the following sense, let me define a quantity omega 1 that is equal to trace of rho 1 minus rho 1 squared. So this is similar to purity we know from qubit case. That's typically what people know. And you put the condition that this is equal to 0. In other words, you want to say that rho 1 is equal to rho 1 squared. So this is a bit different from the single body reduced density matrix that you know from qubits. So this is also shorthanded as 1 RDM, but for fermions. And because this is, first of all, this is L by L matrix. Second of all, for example, trace rho 1 is equal to n, and stuff like this. And this is a, if it's a Gaussian state, then rho 1 is equal to rho 1 squared. So, and this is the condition that counts this, that determines this. Okay.
Sorry, is there a sense in which this rho 1 is an actual reduced density matrix?
I mean, what do you mean actual?
Trace or something you're left with this?
I mean, it's a trace. It's definitely not a reduced density matrix in this bipartite kind of sense of distinguishable particles, right? So this is a, this is not, this cannot be, so you might be asking, oh, is this related, for example, to some qubit reduced density matrix, let's say via some mapping or something like this, to the one that you're used to? Well, I don't think so. At least I don't know such connection. And there is, I mean, it's quite different. For example, the size of the matrix is the number of modes. So I don't see any obvious connection. Okay.
But it's something like old and
it's like what?
It's something old. It's not a new thing. It was known before. Yes, purity.
Yes, this is a condition that is known to some people. Yes.
Okay.
No, I mean this is there are for some people it's trivial. Some people don't know anything about it, right? So, so this is just introduction. Okay. And then there is condition that is even less people know about it, and even to even less people it's trivial, and that's the one actually we're going to be using. It's a secret weapon. The secret weapon is called Plücker relations. So you define a very weird operator that acts on the tensor product of two fermionic Hilbert spaces. Let me call it omega. And this is something that I think in this language it's only known in the integrability theory literature. So this is not something that people normally consider. In Plücker relations, some quantum information people know it as well, but this language is quite unfamiliar to people normally. So let me define this operator omega that acts on H tensor H. And let me not be very pedantic here. I mean, this thing here annihilates one fermion. This thing here creates one fermion. So you're actually going outside of H if you define H to be the Hilbert space with n fermions, right? So you actually change the number of fermions using these operators, right? But it acts on this tensor product. So it's a thing that does not conserve particle number in the tensor factors, okay? And then you define this interesting condition that is called Plücker relations. Looks like this. Okay, it happens to be that this is sufficient, similarly to purity, by the way. Both of these conditions are necessary and sufficient for the state to be Gaussian. Okay, and this is called relation S, because normally people just write down the list of them, because you just kind of take projections of this kind of vector in the tensor product. You take projections onto various components, and there you go, you have Plücker relations. So this is sort of this kind of covariant form of writing it down.
You mean Plücker relations are bilinear equations on those V's, right?
Yes, indeed. These are, so I will write them down a bit more explicitly later, but let me just write them. Well, I'll write an example right now, okay? So this will be useful. So an example, let's say again, for L equals 4, N equals 2. Would be something that you might have seen before. This kind of classical sort of quantum information, or maybe sort of algebraic geometry of this kind of simple Grassmannians, is equal to this equals zero, right? This happens to be the only non-trivial component of this equation for L equals 4 and equals 2, okay? And many people have seen this condition in other contexts, because I mean that's really the only thing you can write down for L equals 4 and equals 2. This is necessary and sufficient for this state to be fermionic. I mean, it's a bit unusual, it's quadratic. Oh, sorry, thank you. Yes, Gaussian, very good, yes. No, I sometimes say a different thing than I mean, yes. Yes, this is a Gaussian state. If and only if this holds, this is the only non-trivial component. And what else can one say about this? I mean, one can see how this comes about, right? Because V can be decomposed into amplitudes like this, right? And so basically here you have just some sort of equation on this kind of some bilinear equation on V, right? So this is this special case. And we observe the following. That if you just take norm squared of this vector, this happens to be exactly this kind of one purity, the purity of one RDM. Okay. So actually, this way you can see that sort of one implies another, because of course, if the norm is squared is zero, then this thing is zero, and the other way around. So this is going to be our secret weapon, these Plücker relations. Very good. Okay. What's next? Okay, let me write down the scheme of the result. Let me describe to you what the result is. Right. We just discussed Gaussian states, right? And for Gaussian states, the defining conditions are that this one purity, which is equal to... Oh, by the way, let me just briefly introduce a little bit different notation here. So omega 1, using this operator, I mean, the first thing you arrive at is actually not just this expression. The first thing you just arrive at, by definition, is this expression here, sum over PQ V Psi Q dagger Psi P V So here you just sort of take this as an expectation value of omega dagger omega, right? So you put this on the other side and you get this kind of product, okay? And let me call this, so we can recognize already rho 1 here. So this is rho 1. Sorry, these are matrix elements, right? This QP. So these are matrix elements of rho 1. And this is not quite rho 1. Let me call it rho 1 charge conjugate. Rho 1 comma C of PQ. And one can see that this guy here, this matrix, is in this particular, well, in basically this particular matrix, is equal to a Kronecker delta minus rho 1 normal, because you can just commute commute psi PP through psi Q and use those relations, right? So this way you immediately arrive at this omega 1, but let me just suggestively put this different formula trace of rho 1, rho 1c, because this is a slightly nicer form than this one, and in generalized case, it's going to be a much nicer form than the one where you don't use this rho 1c, so I'll keep it. So we have this omega 1 equals to trace rho 1, rho 1c. Equals zero, so that's the condition, defining condition for the state to be Gaussian, or alternatively, which is the same, you have omega VV equals zero. Then furthermore, you have Wick's rule for observables, and actually also for amplitudes in a certain sense, and I will describe that a bit later. So you can decompose sort of amplitudes of higher order excitations in terms of amplitudes of kind of single particle excitations. So I will describe that a bit later, because this will be a good a nice ingredient for our result. And then actually you can write down an ansatz for an arbitrary Gaussian state, which will look almost like the one I gave there in the definition, but this will be a tight ansatz. S. So T1 I will define as sum of PQ. Well, P belongs to S, and Q does not belong to S, of this thing, of the same thing I've written there. Theta PQ psi Q dagger psi P. So you have to imagine sort of, if you take this, so this is relative to this state S here, which is the reference. So if you take this particular set of modes S, and you kind of put a hole at the site P, at mode P, and you transport it to site Q. So this elementary operator is the sum over such things, this kind of single particle excitations. Okay, particle hole excitations. So you specifically take P from S, and specifically take Q away from S. Okay, and so this happens to be a tight ansatz. By the way, it's not like the other, like if you were to write down that ansatz, the rest of the things vanish. In fact, I mean, if you want it to be a unitary rotation, which is a typical thing to consider, like this should be an anti-Hermitian operator, and of course you have both particle hole and hole particle transformations, right? So, but this is sort of this kind of non-unitary transformation, that's why I need a normalization here. And this is a tight ansatz for Gaussian states.
So for William, tight.
Okay, thank you. Tight in the sense that you have the same number of parameters as you have the degrees of freedom in the set of Gaussian states. Okay, now we're gonna generalize this. We're gonna have the key idea. So this was our let me call it H1. So this will be my Gaussian states for k equals 1. Now let me introduce this kind of set of states for arbitrary k, such that you have this inclusion sequence, right? So like I described before, such that, like I also announced before, the total Hilbert space corresponds to k equals n plus 1. And it will be defined very simply that I just take kth power of omega, and I declare it to be 0. Okay. You can see already why it's an inclusion, because if omega to some lower power equals 0, then omega to a higher power also will be 0, because just composition of operators. And the things that are remaining to see, let's say compared to this motivation board that I wrote, is that are these states meaningful physically? Are they relevant to anything? And do I have a polynomial-sized ansatz for those states? Okay. And alternatively, you can write down a measure that has to vanish, similarly like you had for purity. It will be basically a trace of a thing that's called KRDM, so K-body reduced density matrix, times its charge conjugate, which will be defined very similarly to how that pair is defined. And if you're not familiar with K-body reduced density matrix, I will introduce that in a minute for fermions. And that has to be 0 for this to belong to HK. Now, it happens that this implies a generalized Wicks rule, but only for amplitudes. So it's generalized Wicks rule. I mean, again, intuitively, I will explain it. It means that you have this kind of higher order amplitudes of higher order excitations, and they can be decomposed not into single particle excitations, but into excitations of up to order k. So of up to kind of, you can kind of, now you can excite like basically whole clusters, so you have more sort of independent amplitudes that you have to decompose into. Similarly, like here, you have this kind of single particle matrix elements, but in that you can have a similar thing for amplitudes, and in this case it generalizes, so the elementary objects here will be a little bit bigger, will not just be Q and P, which are single particle, okay? And this generalized Wicks rule happens to be an equivalent statement to, because you have a lot of amplitudes, right? A generalized Wicks rule for any amplitude, well, that's exponentially many equations, so how is that useful? Well, the cool, interesting thing is that this implies that this V can be written, so any state from HK can be written like some function. So again, you have some amplitude VS, and then you have some function of T1 through TK acting on S, right? And TK equals to sum over theta capital P, capital Q, okay? Capital Q dagger, capital psi P, such that P is a subset of S and Q doesn't have to do anything with S. So its intersection is empty set. So you can draw this as sort of, you have S, and now you can take bigger chunks and bigger excitations. Here you have P, here you have Q, right? And such that P equals Q equals K, right? So that's the sum of generators of kth order, right? And they will play sort of, these sums will play sort of independent role in this ansatz in some sense. So this function is actually sort of ugly. I don't quite like this function. I'm not happy with it. I'm sure when I write it down, you will not be very happy with it either. But it's a function. And the number of parameters in this ansatz is actually polynomial, because if you just count the number of degrees of freedom, these thetas, in the operators, it will be a polynomial of order k. So this is an n to the k size ansatz in that sense.
Is this similar to what I get by doing perturbation theory and truncating some order?
That will be on the next board. So this is not the same as perturbation theory, and these states are also bigger than perturbation theory, but truncated perturbation theory is actually a special case, an example of states in HK. So that's one of the reasons we think it's physically meaningful, because you know it includes perturbation theory and more. Okay, I think this is what I wanted to say here. Any other questions? So I will now go to sort of into a bit more details. Let me give some details about this omega k equation here. So, I mean, there is not so much that I didn't discuss there, but about the definition. But I mean, first of all, note that this is the same as you have capital psi r, capital psi r dagger. Because if you look at the operator omega, and you take a sort of kth power of it, you will have basically all sort of monomials of size k, and I'll call these monomials r, acting on v tensor v equals zero. So that's one way of thinking about it. Another aspect is that, well, what is omega k? Again, similarly to how I suggested already, with one in one particle case, well, let me introduce this k factorial normalization. Don't worry about it. It's just so that things look a bit nicer. Squared. This thing is equal to trace of rho k charge conjugate. And rho k is a matrix in this kind of in the sequences of P and Q, or which have length k, right? So it's actually a tensor of with 2k indices, okay? But it's a matrix in this kind of first k indices versus the second k indices, and this is the normal k body reduced density matrix. So some people know a lot about this. And the charge conjugate, similarly to how it was for in one particle case or in Gaussian case, is this psi q dagger v. So you sort of like commuted psi p through psi q dagger, not noticing these kind of deltas that come up. And that's the reason why I'm writing this way, because in principle this thing is totally a function of rho k, okay? Because you can just commute these psi daggers through, and you'll get, well, one thing to know is that rho k prime for k prime smaller than k can be obtained as a marginal, right? Some kind of, you kind of do some tracing out procedure similar to how we do it for qubits. is a marginal of rho k. So from higher order k reduced density matrix, you always can obtain lower order. So there is some nice structure like that. So in principle, when you commute things through, you get also, because of the delta constraints, the delta factors, you get also a lower order reduced density matrix. But all is eventually a function of rho k. And rho k will be the final thing that will everything will depend on. So this is one of the senses in which this thing, you could call it or think about it as a sort of k-particle correlation measure, right? So it's a sort of a correlation, some fermionic, genuinely fermionic correlation measure. It goes beyond entanglement just because already Gaussian states are volume-low entangled in general. And this is a k-body measure for fermions. And another way you can think of it as a k-body measure is in the sense that omega k equals 0 implies omega k prime equals 0 for all k prime bigger than k, like I already said. And this is true just because of this kind of, you just have to attach a bunch of omegas here to obtain this, which means that sort of you can have a state which is kind of three particle uncorrelated, then it will be definitely five particle uncorrelated. But if a state is five particle uncorrelated, it doesn't mean that it will be a three particle uncorrelated, right? So this is a sort of hierarchy. So, I mean, all of these are sort of just intuitions and mnemonics to think about this hierarchy, in effect.
Question? So does the, like, the magnitude of omega k give us a sense of how bad an approximation that, say omega 1 is finite?
Yes.
Like, if it's bigger, does it mean that a Gaussian approximation is worse? Like, is there any sense in which it quantifies the goodness of approximation?
Yeah, thanks. No, in some sense, yes. In the sense that actually the magnitude of omega will eventually limit the magnitude of these parameters theta. So basically you say, yeah, if omega is small, not necessarily zero, but small, you are throwing away only small parameters in this ansatz. So that's one way of thinking about it.
Okay.
So which means that, I mean, of course, this is a complicated function, so it doesn't directly propagate. But at least in the sense of kind of in the plus epsilon sense, like, yeah, if you have that measure that's really small, then definitely those things can be neglected. And then real analysis of this is something that actually is one of the open questions.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a related question. So suppose I know omega k is not zero, but small.
Yes.
Does that naturally bound the higher omega k?
Yes, I think so. I mean, basically, through operator norm of omega, you can do it, right?
Maybe you can mention some, like, at least, like, pictorially, some real cases, like some examples.
Yes, so I will now talk about examples. Okay, let me...
You also have two more boards.
What?
You also have two more boards.
Okay, let me do but people are a bit more distant from that one.
Ah, okay.
I don't know. Okay, let me use the other board. Let me know if it's not legible. Okay. So, okay, I don't know how much time I have. Let me just check in a little bit. Okay, I have legally I have 15 minutes. Let me.
Let's say half an hour.
Okay. Nice. Okay. Then let me say the following. Okay, nice. Now that's actually perfect. Okay, so now let me just, after this kind of exposition, let me say what's the plan for the rest. I'm actually going to talk about examples. I'm going to talk about the Weak's theorem and the ansatz. So how that comes about. I mean, at least in some very, let's say on the very crude level, how the derivation goes, and do some, yeah, and discuss sort of open questions and connections to kind of other areas. So let me start with the examples. Well, any state of the following form is an example. So examples in HK, right? Any state of the following form. So it's kind of actually a simple, but at the same time, not so simple class of examples. So any state which has the following condition, I will help with the picture. If you have sort of two multi-indices S1 and S2, and you take the symmetric differences, the size of the symmetric differences, or the symmetric difference, which is larger than k, if basically the S1 and S2 are such that this is bigger than k, then V of S1, either V of S1 equals 0 or V of S2 equals 0. Okay? So any state of this form is an example. So how to think about it? Basically, sort of if you know already that in the support of state V, you have some certain, you have certain multi-index S, then you already know that you cannot have, you know, if k is some kind of finite number, much smaller than n, then you already know that like this is not a legal, component in this class of states. You basically know that you can only allow so much deviation from S. Moreover, if you include another state, you can also allow only so much deviation from both of those. So it's sort of this kind of small set, which is also polynomial size, and well, small in the sense it's not exponentially large, right? But it's kind of big, but it's not exponentially large. And this naturally is actually, for this class of states, this omega k VV vanishes almost trivially, in the sense that you can just look at sort of at how the components of this thing look like. And you remember there was this, well, actually, the example is still there, V of 1, 2, V of 3, 4, etc. You might have, in that particular equation, you might have some, all amplitudes are non-trivial, but the sum total is 0, right? So that would be kind of an untrivial case. Well, here, with that condition, each of the terms will vanish. Okay, so it's sort of like this. Like basically, if you have a situation like this, then basically you always have product of terms, always have products of terms, V of S1 and V of S2, one of which will be 0. And the reason basically is that you sort of have to fit this R monomial somewhere here, such that this thing doesn't vanish. Right? And if the size of this difference is larger, is smaller than k, then you will only have 0 contribution. So, okay, so that's roughly the idea. Okay, just trust me, this is an example. If you don't see it, it's fine. I mean, I actually don't know how easy it is to see it because I'm just so used to this already. But just trust me, this is a class of examples. Now, why is this an interesting class? Well, it includes several things. For example, let's just consider a kind of quantum information-y example, which looks very similar to sort of Bell state and GHZ states. So this is kind of a toy example, which allows to already capture quite a bit. For this state, omega to the third power is 0, whereas omega to the fifth power is not 0. Oh, sorry, the other way around. Yes, here omega third is 0 and omega fifth is 0. Everything is amazing. This is, of course, because here you can see the difference between the two, the symmetric difference, so half of the symmetric difference between these two states is 2, right? So basically, for any k that is 3 or larger, omega to that power will vanish. So this is sort of, and this is, by the way, a non-Gaussian state. So omega to the first power will not vanish. Another non-Gaussian state, which you might intuitively think as more non-Gaussian, right? So that's kind of what it sort of captures. You might see that here you excited many more modes compared to this one, right? Here you excited only the 3 and 4, you transformed to 5 and 6, and here you took all the way, all four modes to 5, 6, 7, and 8. Well, here, omega 3 will not vanish, however, omega 5 will vanish. And well, in this particular case, of course, 5 is also equal to n plus 1. But you can also safely assume that basically there are many, many more modes that are occupied here and here, right? So n doesn't have to be equals to 4. Like you can have just basically a lot of modes. If you just imagine the rest of the modes are the same in these two states, right? And this for omega to the 5 will still be 0. I mean, the main point is that you excited a lot of modes, but not too many, so omega 5 is 0. Now, this you could think as kind of a Bell-type state. This is like a GHZ-type state. And you can distinguish between the two, just calculating omega 3, omega 5, and seeing how they correspond to each other. So this is a simple example to get some intuition. And it was actually sort of the motivating example to consider this omega to the k in the first place. Because in physics, or in when you consider quantum circuit bounds, like these kind of, it really matters if you have a big difference in the number of modes that are occupied.
And this is related to perturbation theory truncation.
And the perturbation theory truncation will be just in a second. So indeed, perturbation series. If you look at any state that looks like this, V0 as 0 plus sum over Vs s such that Vs is equal to J over delta, where J is some coupling, delta is some gap, to the power of basically S subtracted as 0. Okay, so this is something that naturally emerges in perturbation theory. If you consider some kind of reference state as 0, and you have some interactions on top, then the way you will write down perturbation series will be of this sort. And if you truncate perturbation series, well, you'll have a bound on this S subtracted as 0, which is the same as there, because this is basically half of the symmetric difference. Okay? And the reason it's half of the symmetric difference is because the number of particles is conserved. So this is also a class of examples. This has that form for if you truncate it at a given or any given order. Now, finally, we wanted to check, okay, this is the kind of a very it's a very idealistic view of fermionic perturbation theory. This is very like, okay, you have a big gap, you have insulator, like this is something that is like for many fermionic systems, perturbation theory was much more subtle than this. So we wanted to look at some real examples, and we did some numerics, and we did some very basic numerics for 1D Hubbard model. At some intermediate interaction. So let's say you have interaction that is equal to the Hopping strength or is equal to 3 times the Hopping strength. And we had various results. I mean, first of all, it's good to set the benchmark for sort of what you would consider big omega or what you consider. So how would you expect omega to look like? Omega is a function of k for a typical state. So take a Haar state. This can be computed for Haar state. Let me draw a logarithm of omega. Logarithm of omega looks like this.
Haar state means the state like random vector. Right?
Yes, random vector in the random many-body fermionic vector.
Okay.
Yes. This will look like this. So where here this is 0, and this is some relatively high value. So this actually grows exponentially. I don't remember how does it scale like n, or I don't remember actually.
Logarithm like n.
Like n. Okay. So. Like the maximum.
Maybe n square.
Okay, so basically it's large. The it's a large exponential. Now for Hubbard model at interaction equals 1, where this is in units of Hopping strength, for ground state we see something like this. Whereas by the way, of course, entanglement is logarithmic, right? So
if it's like logarithm of omega, it would be line, right?
This is a line, yeah. Okay, sorry.
It's a line.
It's linear.
It's exponent.
Okay, no, of course. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, very good. So it decreases exponentially. Okay? And this is something you expect actually from perturbation theory, except here you don't even have a gap. You just have a gapless model and you add some interactions. So this is actually some non-trivial input from numerics. Moreover, if you go to either higher interactions or higher energy, we see states like this. Okay? Which is, like, we see examples. Okay, so we only did very small scale numerics, which is L equals 6, N equals 3, yes?
Yeah. and no, like for Hubble model, n equals 6, because you have double occupation.
Oh, so it's L equals 12, actually. 12 n equals 6. No, very good, yeah. But this is, yes, but we have sort of spin degrees of freedom, so it's the length of the chain is 6, yeah. And here the k, where it kind of starts to drop down, is 3. So it's sort of kind of the first non-trivial Gaussian state from the perspective of this hierarchy. Well, it's the first because of even odd effects, which I don't want to go into. But basically, it's essentially, this is sort of a non-Gaussian state, which is, well, definitely non-Gaussian, because you don't have, you have order 1 omega k. But it is also very, like, to big approximation, it belongs to H3. With this exponential tail, you still have to cut off. Okay, and the reason, so we only partially understand various reasons how this can happen, how you can have this kind of non-perturbative non-Gaussian states. One of the possible reasons is that you have a degeneracy, you have kind of a flat sort of bend, for example, for symmetry reasons, and that splits. And as a result of this, you have non-trivial contribution from various ladder determinants. So that, let's say, is the most simple. So that splits, let's say, upon, like, you had some interactions, and they kind of hybridize, and one of your eigenstate, your excited eigenstate, you're talking about excited eigenstates, this can happen. You have a bunch of slider determinants, all with high components, and as a result of this, you cannot really belong to omega 1, you have some non-trivial state. But also, it doesn't have to be exactly this. For example, for ground state at u equals 3, we see it, and this is not even the case, so we don't have some degeneracy that you split. And in principle, I mean, one can speculate on basically on various physical grounds why this sometimes does happen, which is sort of related to kind of how interaction corresponds to, like, level split and stuff like this. But basically, you expect both from this particular example and also on general grounds that these things should emerge. These kind of non-trivial Gaussian states, which are definitely far from Gaussian states, but also belong approximately to a class with some k which is non-trivial, and in some cases, finite. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about this.
Did you look at the SYK model?
Oh, we checked. It's pretty similar to this.
So it's basically, you think it's at the very top of the hierarchy?
Yes. SYK model seems to be at the top of the hierarchy.
Okay.
I think so, yes. Yes? Yes.
Yeah, so like the general understanding, and also if you take very highly excited state of Hubbard model, you also see picture like this.
Oh yeah.
Like our understanding is that you have like either like exponentially declining with some, maybe some flat region, or you have thermal type of state, and like everything which is thermalized, it would look like thermalized. It's, in a sense, it's similar to like entanglement entropies, that like for ground states or for like sometimes you have like not like maybe logarithmic scaling or something like that, but whatever is thermalized, you immediately have volume low, and like you cannot construct reasonable ansatz for it.
And even there is a dramatic example of the Mott insulator. If you go to very high U, so the interaction is very high, but the state in some respects is trivial. It's sort of, you can describe it with the TJ model, like it's a kind of an it's a Heisenberg antiferromagnet effectively. So it only has spin physics, but actually, well, I mean, sure, probably the ground state is sort of kind of spin singlet, and it's not necessarily an uncorrelated state, but it's kind of disappointing that we also see pretty high correlations in this kind of Mott insulator state. So there are sometimes situations where, which are, I think we understand, which are, well, sort of, well, not necessarily uncorrelated, so we don't quite know what's the relation between this and entanglement in the case where sort of all correlations sit in the entanglement, right?
So but, you're saying large limit, which is basically an antiferromagnet.
Yes. See
this,
yes, Heisenberg antiferromagnet. We seem to see this behavior. Yes. Well, but this, we expect. I mean, because of course, I mean, everybody thinks of antiferromagnet. Yeah, you have nil state and stuff like this. But of course, you don't have nil state. I mean, 1D, it's much more complicated. So basically, there is some non-trivial stuff going on. But the main idea is that if you are sort of close to basically you can quantify how close you are to the Gaussian state, and you're not sort of blinded by the lens of the entanglement, which would say, oh, here you're logarithmic entanglement, entangled, although you're actually in the Gaussian state. So that's kind of the upshot of this. Okay, so that's sort of a little bit of a practical thing. Okay. Let me now actually talk a little bit about the ansatz derivation. And the Vick's rule. Yeah, so basically, I mean, the conclusion from these two guys is that HK kind of contains physically motivated states. It's not just some random way of looking at correlation. What's the deal? Okay, so let me start with a quick k equals 1 exercise. Well, of course, we will not do it in detail, but let me just sketch it for you. So how does the, so like I told you, there is this relation between the amplitude Vick's rule, which you might have never encountered, and the ansatz. So let me just describe it. So the amplitude Vick's rule for the Gaussian states for k equals 1 says this. So you have to sort of imagine you have this slightly determinant S. And you want to ask, okay, what if you took p modes out of it and created q modes on top? And this is a lot of modes. Now, it turns out that this can be expressed in terms of much smaller cases, much, much smaller excitations, where you only took, so you have this kind of p, and you only took this kind of lowercase p. So here the rest are occupied, and here the rest are occupied. So you took only one particle from this. And here as well, you only put one particle q, okay? So that's the amplitude Vick's rule. And actually, this is directly equivalent to the ansatz I showed you for Gaussian states, V of s exponential p of s q not. Well, okay, I don't have to write it down, actually. It's directly equivalent to that guy, okay, to this operator here. And, well, I'm not sure how obvious it is, but sort of, actually, those coefficients theta, it's important input, those coefficients theta are up to a sign equal to these guys directly, are equal to this kind of single particle excitations. So actually, the way to go from this to the exponential is not so hard. There is some direct relation between the ansatz and the amplitude Vick's rule. So for arbitrary k, it becomes a bit more hairy, but there is some sort of similar structure that you can find. Namely, let's just look at these Plücker relations, right? So they are satisfied at level k. These guys, they look like so for various components A and B, you can write down, so A and B are also these kind of sequences, these multi-indices. You can write down, like this equation looks similar to this, like in that example with L equals 4 and equals 2 that I gave you, times some sign that I will not get into equals to 0. So this is the form of this equation, OK? So using the equation of this form, you can transform it into the following useful statement. V of s without p, so you choose a and b appropriately, and you combine them in a certain way. And you can arrive at this interesting statement. You can decompose this guy into V of S P prime Q prime S P prime bar Q prime bar V of S, where, so let's again look at this S without P together with Q. This P prime bar and P prime are basically these things. So here you have P prime, which is sort of a part of P that you took. Here you have part of Q that you put here. So this is Q prime, and this is P. And here you took the other part, so the bar, so the complement inside P. Right? So it's pretty intuitive looking picture, I hope. Okay? So you can decompose this ratio into a product of these ratios, where you now took the size of so you basically took a part of this excitation that is smaller, and this only holds for P's that are of this kind. So if basic excitation is large enough, then you can decompose it into smaller excitations. And this follows from this, because here it kind of eventually boils down to the fact that R here is equal to K, and you have to do a bunch of algebra. But the idea is this: you have this decomposition. Now, what do you do next? Well, imagine this P prime or P bar prime are still too big. Imagine they're still much larger than K. Well, you can decompose it further. You can basically plug it in here and keep changing it, and you can decompose them further. What you arrive at eventually is that quite impressionistically, this thing that you were interested in the beginning for this large P and Q is, I was planning to draw it in pictures, so that's even easier. So you take this large P and Q, and you decompose it similarly to how you did here with the determinant, but a bit different, into sum over partitions of this P and Q into sets P prime Q prime, such that P prime, which is equal to Q prime, otherwise it doesn't make sense, smaller than K. Right? So only in up to K order only up to K order parts of P and Q, and which are set here inside P and inside Q. So these guys, these are dotted lines also there. Okay? So you decompose into products over this kind of amplitude ratios. Okay? And then finally, using this kind of decomposition, carefully tracking all the coefficients and all the signs, and using the generating function method, you can arrive finally at this expression for the ansatz. And the function that you arrive at, and it's actually, it's not obvious that if you have this kind of decomposition, you have that function. Because in principle, naively, this looks like exponentially many equations. But the fact that you can kind of pack it all up into this kind of one polynomially sized ansatz is not obvious. Because it at least depends on the signs, so it's not given that you can do this, but it happens that you can do it. And I will write down the function now, which I didn't write down immediately because it's too scary, but I think one should write it down. And the function looks like this. So it's a function of these variables x1 through and then up to xk, for example, which has the following structure. this monstrosity. So if you have these generators TK, you plug them into this function, and that's the ansatz. And any state in HK can be expressed as this ansatz. Now, okay, so now one wants to discuss a little bit what's sort of next. I mean, we're going to stop here and put it out in the next couple of weeks on archive. But there are a lot of interesting open questions. Well, let me just quickly consult with which ones I wanted to talk about. Okay, I mean, obviously, one may ask, okay, what are the computational applications of this? In particular, the question, I mean, this is this thing, if you plug all those operators into here, this is an operator on the Hilbert space, which you, I mean, you don't necessarily know how to efficiently compute things with. And there are many other also representations like this. I mean, it's always the case. But sort of, it's not obvious that you can do it. We have a couple of ideas that are motivated by the theory of so-called coupled cluster ansatz, where the structure of the ansatz is actually quite kind of similar. It just doesn't have this connection to correlation measures. But people are using ansatzes of the similar structure, where the function is actually an exponential of the sum of operators. Okay? Similarly, like the head exponential here, people just generalized and they just added all kinds of operators like that. So this thing, in principle, also in the limit of small thetas, it actually has the same structure as the coupled cluster ansatz, but at strong correlations, they sort of diverge. Still, they maintain the similar structure where you only have these generators of this kind, of this form. So you can use, and a coupled cluster is a very successful computational method, so we can use some of those, some specific ideas among the ones that are used there. But it's quite open, actually. In particular, there is also a very interesting question where sort of we are doing this in this very broad way. We are taking this kind of H1 and HK, and these are very big sets. But you can make it much more detailed and put it a lot of structure to it, depending on the geometry of your problem. You would expect that many of these coefficients theta would vanish. And you might be able to, and you might want to study different components of this and maybe do some kind of spectral analysis on this. So this is like quite open. It's not clear. Like there seems to be a lot of structure hidden there, which we didn't discover yet. Also, this is actually not a tight ansatz, this one. Because like I said here, it's an implication. It doesn't mean that any state here belongs to HK. And there is some nasty algebraic geometry. I mean, nasty or nice depends on what the answer is if you solve the problem. But right now it looks pretty complicated, but there are some ideas how one might do some smarter algebraic geometry and relate it to. So this is interesting. And also there is this measure omega k can be related to a thing that exists in integrability, which is called Smirnov's R matrix, which is actually the generating function, which in the special case is equal to the generating function of omega k. So you just take z of beta, which is equal to this. And this object is interesting. For example, it's multiplicative if you add two systems. And we don't yet know how to interpret this or how to use this. This omega k is not additive, it's not multiplicative. It has some weird properties if you add things up. But this generating function is multiplicative. But we don't know sort of how to, what is the physical interpretation of it. And finally, I mean, there are also various other sort of ways of thinking about correlations in fermions. One is the so-called n-representability theory, which is sort of connected to SDP relaxations of fermionic problems, which it could be related to this because it also has to do with k-body reduced density matrices. So there is some structure there that might be connected to this, not in any obvious way. And there are also magic states for fermionic computation. So that's something that is also potentially related to this. There are definitely some bounds that you can make kind of from one to another, but it's pretty open what the connection is and what you can say from one to another. So those are various open directions that exist. Yeah, I think I'll stop here.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, good. You briefly mentioned magic states, but it seems like it should be connected because non-Gaussian states are supposed to be like resource states for universal quantum computation.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have expected that this f function would be negative or something for some
for that? Is that
similar to Wigner function or something like this?
Yeah. Do you think, is there a connection?
Oh, you should tell me more about harmonic Wigner functions, because I wish I knew about them. But I don't think it's connected. So, I mean, at least I don't think f is has to be a negative function. I mean, you can just look at a positive function. I mean, you can just look at this guy here, right? I mean, theta is, I mean, I don't know what you mean by negative or positive, but there is no, you cannot, for example, say, you know, thetas are negative or something like this. It's not obvious.
There's the exponent in front of the v of s, positive.
You mean the contracting or expanding operator, that kind of thing? We can, okay, we can talk more about this, but I don't see an obvious connection to Wigner function, or yeah. But magic states, I mean, you can always say that, for example, any state in those HK families should be a magic state for fermionic computation, right?
Uh-huh.
And then you might ask, okay, what can we say about the amount of magic given the rank of K, right?
Is that related?
So we don't know. You can put some bounds, but it's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite, we only have very crude understanding of this.
But any k greater than 1 is magic.
Yes, of course.
Okay, yeah.
But you're saying you're not sure if the hierarchy holds for.
If you don't know, I mean, you can always ask sort of what is sort of the magic gate rank, I guess, of the state, and I'm not sure how this is related. I mean, this is actually also a little bit connects to this multiplicative measure, because the rank, the magic gate rank, is something that you expect to sort of scale, right? If you have many magic states put next to each other, you sort of care about how much, like you can say how much magic there is by putting them next to each other. But this measure is not additive under that. You cannot say anything. Whereas this one is multiplicative, so there might be some connection there, but it's not quite clear. Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about this, obviously. So let me know if you have any other questions. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, thanks.